Who gets to talk about history, especially when that history is brutal and hard to talk about in the first place? That's the subject of a play from Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater. Plus, emoji have become a common form of communication on keyboards around the world, but these little symbols aren't always as diverse as the people who use them. But first, we'll learn about how cases of syphilis are on the rise, especially in areas outside of Chicago.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to this encore edition of the 21st. I'm Brian Moldeen. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear how emojis actually get made from some of the people advocating for more emojis that reflect their daily lives. But first, we've been hearing a lot about the return of measles to the U.S. It's one of many preventable diseases that we associate with another time, but that are actually back and on the rise, according to public health officials. One other example is syphilis. The sexually transmitted disease can cause serious neurological damage. It can even be fatal. But it's completely treatable and curable. The new battleground for the disease is rural counties across the West and Midwest. Here in Illinois, cases have increased almost three times over a decade, with a third of those cases outside Chicago. Lauren Weber has been reporting on this for Kaiser Health News, where she's the Midwest correspondent. Dr. Vidya Sudarshan is an associate professor at SIU Medicine in Springfield and an infectious disease specialist. They spoke with Nyla Boodoo back in May of this year.
Lauren, in your article, you focused on Missouri, and I want to talk about that in a minute. But first, I wonder if we can discuss what's happening here in Illinois. As you look at the data, what have you learned about syphilis cases in Illinois over the past 15 years?
If you look at the data in Illinois, first off, it's 10th out of 50 states when it comes to syphilis, which isn't necessarily that much of a surprise considering Chicago. You know, syphilis is usually really concentrated in more urban areas, and considering Chicago's size, that makes sense to some degree. But since 2008 to 2017, cases of syphilis have nearly doubled, almost tripled. You've gone from, for primary and secondary syphilis, you've gone from 554 cases to 1,225. In that time, you know, from 2014 to 2018, funding to fight syphilis to the Illinois state of Illinois has decreased. Overall, STD prevention funding has gone from $4.3 million to $4.1 million. And when you look at it, I think what's interesting, and as I point out in my story and as we're seeing really broadly across the Midwest and West, you're seeing these cases pop up more and more and kind of diffuse more and more outside of these urban centers where there's frankly more infrastructure and more knowledge around combating it. So in Chicago, you know, back in, I believe it was 2014, you had 2008, you had 129 cases that were outside of Chicago. Now you have 437. And that's,
wow. Almost,
that's more than a third of your state's cases are now taking place outside of your major urban area. When you look at Missouri, I think it's a little even worse there. You've got almost 45% taking place outside of their major cities. And I think Chicago, if you look at syphilis in general, a map of syphilis rates over the years, it's kind of a U shape. It's the coasts and the south predominantly, and it's almost like a net. And so I think we're seeing this trend where it continues to kind of rise north and diffuse into these states in the Midwest and West that have kind of been the last grounds that haven't seen this explosion of cases as much. And it makes sense to me that Illinois is maybe, you know, a year or two behind what we're seeing in Missouri and Oklahoma and some of these other states, because it's the way that the net is kind of catching up, it would be one of the last ones to see this reflection.
So we're going to get into reasons for why this is happening, how you treat this. But Dr. Sundaration, you work in and around Springfield. Is what Lauren's saying, are you seeing this among the communities you're serving? What kind of numbers are you seeing?
Absolutely. There has been a spike in the numbers that we see here in our clinics and in the local public health departments as well. There are multiple reasons, and as Lauren pointed out correctly, there has been a decrease in funding. So that amounts to lesser resources for education for people at risk, the staff that is taking care of patients that present with symptoms, to help them identify these early, to be able to counsel them effectively, for all that resources are needed. Syphilis is a reportable condition, so all the labs that are positive for a syphilis test get notified. The public health departments get notified. They're supposed to by law within 7 days. We do have a better way of screening, better way of reporting, and that kind of may account for a little bit of an increase too. But in addition to that, I would also say for heterosexual behaviors, use of IV drugs has gone up too, methamphetamine particularly, which was also reported by CDC recently. So use of IV drugs increases the sexual risk behaviors, which have led to an increased overall risk and increase in syphilis as well as other STIs. Partner services, people need to use that more, know how to use them, inconsistent condom use, concurrent sexual partnerships, and then also a general stigma that's associated with STIs and HIV, all that has also led to decreased utilization of healthcare resources and services.
So, Dr. Sundaresan, I mean, when we think about the opioid epidemic, you're saying that this plays a part in this as well. When we're thinking not just about STIs in general, but in this case, maybe even the spread of syphilis?
Well, because the risk factors are essentially the same. You have an increased chance of high-risk behavior with the use of IV drug use. So as the other STIs increase, syphilis correspondingly increases as well.
And then apart from that, I wonder what populations you're seeing in Springfield. You mentioned at-risk populations. Who would that be?
So mainly reported are men having sex with men. That's the predominant high numbers or high risk population that we see. But we have also seen an increase in pregnant women, particularly in our clinics. We have seen with the screening that has improved, there has been a slight increase in that number. And heterosexual risk people at risk, again, with use of IV drug use.
Lauren, when we're thinking about the at-risk populations, and I wonder when we're also thinking about rural communities, what are some challenges here when we're thinking about people, first of all, recognizing that they have syphilis and then also getting treated?
I mean, there's many, right? I mean, look, syphilis is commonly known as the great imitator. It's difficult necessarily to diagnose, especially if you haven't seen very many cases. And in some of these more rural areas where there might be more stigma around sexual partners, multiple sexual partners, or men having sex with men, that, you know, that adds to treatment difficulties. You know, I know for my story in Missouri, you know, we had one patient who was told, oh, honey, only hookers get syphilis, from their local provider. So there certainly is, I mean, still to this day, a lot of stigma around STDs and STIs that, you know, prohibits some treatment. And on top of that, you know, like I said, it's called the great imitator, and you have these areas in these more rural communities that haven't seen cases of syphilis anytime recently. It's not necessarily top of mind as something that you would diagnose. And I think that that is playing into some of this, you know, rise, because people don't necessarily catch it, and then they spread it to other folks.
And so when we're seeing communities, I know our producers were reaching out to different public health departments. And I know in Wabash County, they told us they didn't have any cases for 9 years. And then they had 3 cases all in 1 year. Are we seeing cases having anything in common in terms of how this is spreading?
I mean, I would say that there is, you know, I don't necessarily know if it's something in common. I think the doctor pointed out as well, the drug use risk factor is something that we're certainly seeing playing into a lot of folks that have, you know, reported that they have syphilis. I think another thing is we're seeing an increase, and I believe it was in this Wabash County, they talked about how those 3 patients potentially had a link to a dating app. And, you know, in my conversations with public health experts, one of the new challenges for public health officials which, you know, one of them told me was that, you know, you can't just get into Grindr. It's difficult. You know, the days of sitting at the local bar and kind of seeing how an STD could travel are gone. You know, there's a lot more access to more sexual partners through somewhat more anonymized apps. So it can contribute to more difficulty in finding and informing partners that they may have been exposed.
Dr. Sudarshan, I wonder, to Lauren's point about doctor education, what you think it looks like among the medical population outside of big cities like Chicago or St. Louis in terms of making sure that doctors are informed about knowing how to treat this. I imagine this would be primary care doctors. It would be really important for them to be aware of this, correct?
Absolutely. So primary care, a lot of times patients seek help in the emergency room too, because many of them are young, they don't really have primary care physicians. So the first line or the first point of contact would be in an emergency room situation as well. So increased education is very important. And, you know, with syphilis, like Lauren was pointing out, it is a great imitator. It can present with many symptoms, and there are multiple stages of syphilis, and there are different symptoms for different stages. To be able to identify that, you need to have seen adequate numbers. The primary syphilis or the initial presentation is with a painless ulcer. A lot of times the patients themselves do not notice it because it's painless.
Is that where, and that's, okay, an ulcer you said?
Yeah, a painless ulcer. So, and since it does not have any pain, it does not even catch the attention of the patient. So there are multiple manifestations of the disease, and primary syphilis can be easily missed, was what I'm trying to say.
Mm. And then once it's contracted, what are the risk factors for people in terms of what can happen to you?
So once it is contracted, it needs to be treated appropriately. And it's a very simple treatment. It's one rather painful injection of penicillin, but it is very effective. This is one organism which can easily be treated with penicillin, and we haven't seen drug resistance. So that's a blessing. And then if we are able to diagnose patients in secondary syphilis or latent or a later stage of syphilis, then it may be 3 injections. If somebody presents with neurosyphilis, neurologic manifestations, it may be an IV.
That's pretty far advanced, I imagine, at that point, right?
It is.
Lauren, so how, when we're looking at these treatments, how expensive are they, especially, I guess, at the initial level?
Well, honestly, the doctor might be better equipped to answer that one, but I do know that costs have gone up as clinics have been unable to cover some of the costs in different areas. I mean, in general, sexual health clinics, and I think this gets to kind of one of the core reasons I think behind all of this is crumbling public health infrastructure. And part of that's funding. I mean, over the last 10 years, we've seen something like, you know, even in 2012 alone, we saw 21 sexual health clinics across the U.S. close. And so, you know, you're seeing these clinics, there's less sexual health clinics, they're open less time, they don't have as many hours, they don't have as many places, and they're not able to cover as many costs. So some more of those costs are being directed back to the patients who may not want to cover those costs and so may never go get tested themselves. You know, I had folks in Missouri tell me that, you know, sometimes these shots for Bicillin would cost somewhere around $400 depending, but it really, you know, it depends, but that's a lot of money. And kind of this lack of funding and this kind of lack and spiral of crumbling public health infrastructure really all contributes to more cases, more concern, and, you know, a future that we're going to see more of this happening.
Dr. Sundaresan, what would you like to see in terms of funding and thinking about not just education, but prevention and treatment?
So there was a national shortage of penicillin not long ago, but now that's resolved. Definitely more resources are required, and education is foremost, not only for the patients, but also for people that are going to be managing these patients. Counseling funding is, again, important, and resources and training, again, important for counseling as well. That would be another area that we should focus our attention to.
And Lauren, I wonder, when we're thinking also about rural areas as specific challenges, I'm thinking particularly of when you're in maybe a smaller community, anonymity can be a difficult thing. And I wonder how much that, when we're talking about the stigma around this, that prevents people from going to their doctor in the first place.
Absolutely. I had the head of STD prevention in Missouri told me that many folks are worried about going to their local doctor's office because, you know, maybe the receptionist will talk around town, or frankly, maybe their doctor is going to call their parents. You know, I mean, it's and also maybe it's the same doctor who's also your Sunday school teacher and your soccer coach. So especially when, you know, the local provider is so integral to part of the community, which is has wonderful health benefits on that side. But for some sexually transmitted diseases, there is a lot of, you know, social stigma that still persists. And, you know, that plays into some of this.
Just before we end here quickly, Lauren, as you're continuing to report this out, what are you looking at next? I imagine the funding structure is an important part of this.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, look, I mean, from 2013 to 2018, the federal funding for STD prevention stayed flat at $157 million, but that essentially equates to a 40% decrease in purchasing power. So at the end of the day, even though the funding nationally has stayed somewhat steady with inflation, it's gone down tremendously. So, you know, as we kind of track these clinics closing, the funding really not being adequate, and the case count rising, I really think we're going to have to keep an eye on seeing where this goes.
That's Lauren Weber, a Midwest correspondent with Kaiser Health News. We've tweeted out her story. I want to thank her, along with Dr. Vidya Sundaresan, for being with us from SIU Medicine in Springfield. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, a play revisits one of the first recorded genocides in modern history and what it means to tell that story today. I'm Brian Moldeen. That's coming up in just a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. Welcome back to a special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Brian Moldeen. In the early 1900s, the Herero and Nama people of Namibia were murdered by German colonizers. Scholars estimate that 80% of the Herero and 50% of the Nama were killed. And even though the term genocide really wasn't created until after World War II, this is considered the first genocide of the 20th century. If you've never heard of it, you're probably not the only one. And that fact is the subject of a play staged at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. It also toured six Chicago neighborhoods in partnership with the Park District and Library, and it was presented to high school students as part of Steppenwolf for Young Adults. The title of the play is a mouthful. It's called We Are Proud to Present, a presentation about the Herero of Namibia, formerly known as Southwest Africa, from the German Südwest Africa, between the years 1884 and 1915. And it's a play about six students who are working on a presentation about the Herero. In March, Nyla Boodoo spoke with the director, Hallie Gordon, and Carmen Scott Berea, director of enrichment programs at BUILD, a community partner at Steppenwolf.
Hallie, what did you know about the Herero people before you started working on this play?
I only knew the title of this play, so I was not familiar with it, only through this play. And the playwright was very, she was actually writing a different play when she came across this genocide, and she was struck, the playwright who's Jackie Siblis Drury, she was shocked that she'd never heard of this genocide before, and she was also struck by some of the imagery around this genocide, which was very close to the challenges America has and continues to have with racism.
And by that imagery, Hallie, what do you mean by that?
Well, there was one documented of a lynching that happened with the Herero, and that image specifically struck her as very American.
How did you research all of this?
It was part of our whole process in presenting the play, is we actually, we had our education staff do some initial research for our study guide, which is online. And then we had the actors actually do their own research, because part of the themes and part of the ideas of the play is whose story gets told from whose perspective. So we had the actors research certain segments of this genocide, as well as to learn more about Africa. And they brought in what's actually we use on our set now is a timeline, maps, resources, all of that are items that the cast actually went out and researched.
And so, Hallie, I wonder, when we're thinking about this, I mentioned briefly the play unfolds with six characters. They're students who are putting together this presentation about the Herero. And I think central to this is this idea, right, of who gets to tell the story. So I wonder, with that context, if you can kind of present to us the six different characters that we see in this play.
When I programmed it, I decided, because of this big question about storytelling and who tells whose story, is that I decided I really wanted to work with a co-director, and Gabby Randall, who also co-directed this, who's an amazingly brilliant African-American woman, and I kind of decided that it would be really great to think about the ways in which the characters in the play create an environment that is hostile, and that Gabby and I would do the opposite. So we would create an environment in which context and knowledge and fact and truth could actually grow. And, you know, Jackie, the playwright, mentions no names of the characters, only actor one, actor two, actor three, actor four, actor five, actor six. And then she refers to them as white man, another white man, black man, another black man. And I think it's really interesting the way in which this allows for also the fact that the Herero, we've lost the Herero names who were lost in the genocide as well. And so there's a correlation between that and also just the meta aspects of the play, meaning it's a play within a play.
I'm speaking with Hallie Gordon, who's the director of We Are Proud to Present, a presentation at Steppenwolf. Carmen Scott-Boria is also with us. She's the director of enrichment programs at BUILD, a community partner with Steppenwolf. Carmen, I wonder if you can explain a little bit about, for you, what was most attractive to you about the idea of this play in particular when we're thinking about it being presented to young adults.
So first of all, I think we want to expose young people to the arts. And so having the opportunity with Steppenwolf to bring it to our students, when many times they may not feel comfortable coming out into different areas to see a play, bringing it to them sounded like a wonderful idea. So that in and of itself was great. Secondly, trying to figure out how we talk about race, how we talk about stories that are not told, especially when many times the stories that are told about our communities and our young people are so negative. We want to think about the stories that are not told and their stories, and that there's power in that.
And there are two lines of the play that really stuck out to me. And Carmen, related to what you were just saying, the first was when one of the young black actors says, "I don't know my ancestry. I don't know who I am." And I wonder how much of this is about understanding and knowing stories, and also what happens when you can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I love that speech that you're talking about, because it is another white man who just goes on this kind of like long monologue about his great-great-grandfather and the fact that he has knowledge of his story, that he can go back home to where his lineage is a big conflict in the play, because the African-American actors can't. They don't, there are so many lost relatives from slavery and also it mirrors directly the genocide in Herero and the loss of life there and them not having a lineage because of that. So that is a really big, important thing that I don't think a lot of students nor adults really kind of think about a lot.
So there was also another line, the other line that really stuck with me was about walking in other people's shoes. And I think that's a phrase we use a lot. And I thought it was an interesting perspective to hear one of the actors say, actually, no, you can't do that. You can't walk in other people's shoes.
We're finding the Herero in us.
No, we're finding the Herero in us.
We are all trying to find the Herero.
We're all finding Germans in you.
Well, I don't only want to be German.
Too bad.
I want another part.
Well, you can't be an African.
Well, I think I can.
You can't.
I just need to
find
it in my body.
What if you were German sometimes? That doesn't make any sense.
Yes, he can't play a German.
Oh, I could play a German.
Guys.
If we were going to pull some...
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And it comes from the white actor, too. The interesting thing is that so many of the characters in the play are right, and they're also wrong. And this is an instant where this actor is right. This idea of, you know, that the fact that you think you can wear somebody else's shoes, but in actuality, you don't know. And that is so true, especially in terms of what we're dealing with today. It's like you don't know what another person is going through, you know, and to assume that you have a certain knowledge base without communicating is just, it's not helpful to any conversation. And it's also not helpful to creating neighborhoods or communities that thrive.
I'm speaking with Hallie Gordon. She's the director of We Are Proud to present a presentation. It's a Steppenwolf for Young Adults production. Carmen Scott Boria is also with us. I wonder if you guys can just explain, just to your point, Hallie, about community, about Steppenwolf for Young Adults and what the whole idea of how many young people are seeing this play.
Yeah, I mean, Steppenwolf for Young Adults, we program two plays a year, and the youth conversation is central to how I choose the season, meaning what is it that I want the conversation to be between students and teachers and our teaching artists and our education team.
Carmen, I wonder how you all felt at Build about the topic matter here. This is a tough topic to tackle for anyone, let alone for young people. This topic of genocide, of racism, there's some really tough moments, particularly as the play sort of builds to just getting harder and harder to watch and experience towards the end. I wonder how you feel about presenting these really tough topics to younger people.
I think our young people are experiencing things every day that are really tough. And so to see this play and to get an opportunity to think about it outside of the context of what they're dealing with every day, and that there's a level to which history is repeating itself yet again. At what point are we going to really think about the stories? At what point are we really going to think about the pain that we've endured, and how do we make change? And so the opportunity to talk about this and bring this to young people, we're open to it. And so we made a huge effort and even requested that Steppenwolf do an extra show for us so that it is just for young people, because they need to, one, have things that are specific for them, where we're tailoring it to them and making sure that they have permission from school and that schools are on board with this. And just another opportunity to talk about this problem and to say, this has happened before. Let us figure out how we don't do this anymore.
Hallie, I do wonder about how you balance that, because I imagine there's probably more concern or reluctance on the part of adults or parents when thinking about exposing their children to something like this than the kids themselves or the teenagers have, right?
Yes. Yeah, this is a big conversation with our education department and the way that they handle this tough material. I mean, we've had a couple schools that decided that this was just too tough for them and they weren't ready for it. And that I would much rather them make that decision than come and not know how to have a conversation about the material that they saw. So we're very aware that we're kind of pushing boundaries a little bit in terms of content. But it's also, this play is so much about about history and about what is being told to us and what is not, and whose lens is that information being told through. And I really feel like these youths are, they're the voice of the next generation, and they need to understand the context in which, you know, they're about to take over.
Yeah. I also think in the play, it does show a level of agency and empowerment when one of the Black actors, you know, just continuously stands up for the fact that the Herero people are not being talked about, and that their stories are important and need to be told. And so I think just watching him continuously push that is important for young people to see. So the content might be difficult, but there's also some underlining strength there that young people can pull from around just continuing to push and say, no, this is what we need. This is what's important. And that comes out in the play.
What kind of reactions have you been getting from the students who've seen this?
It's been actually really amazing in terms of, I mean, there are things that they say where I'm like, oh my God, I didn't even think about that. There was a student who talked about the idea of appropriation and how do you acknowledge what appropriation is versus appreciation of that culture. And to me, that was a really interesting comment. One, because the beginning of the play is very humorous, even though there's tons of cultural appropriation that's happening. We still feel like we can laugh because it's funny and silly, and then it gets darker, and the humor would be recognized at another time as humor is no longer recognized as humor now. And so the playwright really puts this interesting spin on what we laugh at and what we don't and how we make those choices.
So I saw this play last week, and in the talk back after the play where everyone sort of gathers to process it, your co-director, Hallie, Gabrielle, ended by asking the audiences what's next. And I wonder if I could just end by asking both of you what you hope, not just the students, but it's mostly students who are seeing this, what they'll take away from this.
For me, I partly hope they'll do their own investigative work on news. What is truth? What is fiction? Who are the sources that this information is coming from? There are always multiple sides of a story, and you can't rely on any one source, but it actually takes practice, and it actually takes curiosity to be able to really think about where we come from, how this country was made, and how we can change it. And I'm hoping that the youth will be more up for even debating and questioning what teachers are teaching them and just like really being curious about the information that they're getting.
Carmen, what about you?
Yeah, I would echo that as well. I think it's important that young people and all of us really think about what's being told to us and what's not being told to us. And how do we take the initiative to really think about what are those other stories, giving respect to the oral stories, and that not just things that are written and told to us are the only thing that we should take as truth, but that there are some real wonderful stories or not so wonderful stories out there that we need to acknowledge, and that young people will be encouraged to look for those as well.
That's Carmen Scott-Berea, Director of Enrichment Programs at BUILD, a community partner at Steppenwolf. Nyla Boodoo spoke with her and Director Hallie Gordon back in March. Coming up after the break, almost everyone with a cell phone uses emojis on a regular basis. We'll learn how they get made and what's behind the push for more diverse emoji options. I'm Brian Moldine. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moldine. If you keep in touch with friends and family through text message or maybe use an app like Slack at work, you've probably used an emoji or two, those little smiley face symbols you can find on your smartphone keyboard. Of course, now emojis include much more than just faces. You can find everything from food to animals to emoji couples or emoji families. There are prayer hands. Maybe you use them all the time and didn't even know they're called emojis. That variety is part of the reason why almost everyone on the internet has gotten in on the emoji game. Adobe says emojis are used by a full 92% of the world's online population. But even with more than 3,000 emojis to choose from, you can't always find the one you're looking for to express yourself or one that reflects you. Rangeetha Kumar is an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Illinois. She and her colleagues actually created a bubble tea emoji. Melissa Thermidor is a member of Emojination, an international grassroots group that works to make emojis more inclusive of diverse backgrounds. She's also social media lead at the National Health Service in the UK. They both spoke with Nyla Boodoo this past summer.
Melissa, since you recently went through the process of creating an emoji, I wonder if first you can explain for us, those of us who don't know how this process works, who actually approves emojis?
Oh, that's a complex question. So the proposals are drafted by individuals like me, yourself, and anyone else who sort of has a keen interest in a character that they'd like to see. That then gets submitted to the emoji subcommittee. They meet about twice a week for about 45 minutes to discuss proposals, and then that proposals that are accepted are then passed on to the Unicode Technical Committee, and they meet quarterly to decide on emoji characters that'll, I guess, be shortlisted and make it onto keyboards eventually. And the entire process from start to finish takes about 18 months.
And then that's eventually gets rolled out to different platforms.
Yeah, based on vendors' timelines. So Apple might release it at a later time from Android. It really does depend on the vendor's timeline.
And Rangeetha, emojis originally, or emoji, I should say, originally were Japanese? Is that where it was started?
That's correct. The original set came from Japan. I believe it was in 1999.
And now when we think about how ubiquitous they are, I wonder, when we think particularly about apps, Rangeetha, how much emojis have made apps successful? I'm thinking about Slack coming to mind. That's a messaging. A lot of workplaces use it now as kind of an instant messaging and file sharing service. Venmo, which is like an online payment. How important are emojis to those apps?
I think actually Slack has attributed a lot of its virality in some sense to the fact that you can react with emoji to messages from your coworkers. So it kind of makes the workplace communication in the workplace feel less formal and more fun.
Right. And when that gets to, I think, when I think about how often I use the thumbs up emoji on Slack, probably about 50 times a day, I wonder, when we're thinking about that, I was very happy when the different shades of colors came out, because I was like, OK, I can pick the brown emoji that is my shade of brown. Melissa, when we think about the organization you're part of, Emoji Nation, where did that come from? And can you tell us about how this group came about and how important diversity is to a group like Emoji Nation?
Yeah, of course. It was actually set up by Jennifer Lee, who was the original proposal writer for the dumpling emoji. Demi is Chinese American, and she saw a need in that space to sort of include more different voices and representation. So she set up Emoji Nation several years ago under the sort of tagline, Emoji for the People by the People. And it's exactly that. It's an entirely diverse group of individuals with different perspectives and experiences that can sort of weigh in around what's required or what's missing in that space, you know. And we all sort of congregate on this Slack community where we share emojis, advice, and tips to help get these proposals through.
And in fact, Melissa and Ranjitha, this is the first time you guys are probably talking in person, right? Because I imagine you've communicated on Slack quite a bit.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe in the future we will meet in person. But yeah, I know Melissa purely through the Emoji Nation Slack channel.
Melissa, what made you, why did you want to get involved with Emoji Nation?
Yeah, so I've lived in quite a few places around the world. My husband is South Asian. I lived in India for about 5 years, and I'm a Black woman myself. And I wanted to be able to sort of express myself as well, and it felt like there wasn't anything there that reflected me as an individual, my family, and my life experiences. And I think the interracial emoji proposal is a great step in that direction, and Emoji Nation as well is so reflective of different voices around the world, and I thought, why not be part of this?
Melissa, can you tell us more about that interracial couple emoji, how that happened and how that came about?
Yeah, sure. So that initially, I believe, to my understanding, that was an initial proposal from Tinder, who really wanted to sort of get more mixed-race people. And
Tinder, the dating app company.
Tinder, the dating app.
That Tinder, site. Okay.
Tinder, the dating company, really wanted to sort of reflect the growing demographic of mixed race relationships, and the fact that, you know, there is a growing demographic of people who are in mixed race relationships, mixed race ethnicity, but there wasn't a way for us to sort of express that. I myself, I'm in an interracial relationship, and it was really about sort of being able to express who you're with or what your family represents, no matter what platform or however you choose to express that. So they then drafted a proposal, reached out to Emoji Nation, and we all collaboratively, several of us, worked together on getting that proposal through, and it's set to hit keyboards later this year, which is really exciting.
Ranjitha, I wonder how important, as we talk about how often people are using emoji, I wonder how you, as someone who is in the computer science world, how you think about how we're communicating, because I feel like we're almost coming to a point where oftentimes we're communicating via emoji instead of typing out things or talking to people in person.
Yeah, I mean, in digital communication, I would say that the majority of emoji usage you still see with text accompaniment. So usually they're trying to emphasize certain concepts that are already in the text, or they're replacing certain words in the text with an emoji. But you also see examples where people will use emoji as shorthand, and they might sequence together a few emoji to communicate a little story even. And so, you know, you could have a person running with an airplane to say you're, you know, late for a flight and you're running to catch your flight. And that's kind of precisely, I would say, the usage that we are really interested in from a research perspective. We want to actually understand how much information you can encode in a sequence of five emoji.
That's Ranjitha Kumar, who is an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Illinois. We're also speaking with Melissa Thermidor, whose day job is to be working as a social media lead at NHS in the UK. But she's also, as she's been sharing with us, does work with Emoji Nation. Ranjitha, so where did the bubble tea emoji come from then?
It's actually an interesting story. So as I mentioned, we've been trying to study just how much information emoji can encode. In order to do that, we actually built a social media app. My student, Sujay Kandakar, I guess he graduated, so he's not my student anymore, but he actually developed this app called Opico, and it's available for download right now, so you can try this out. It allows you to do, it's like Foursquare with emoji, so you can react to locations with just emoji, so up to five emoji. And so what we saw when we released the app, and we released it on campus, we have around 1,000 registered users on campus. And what we found is bubble tea is actually very popular. So a lot of people were reacting to bubble tea.
There are a lot of places you can get bubble tea on campus in Champaign,
this
in Urbana.
This is true, yeah. Right. So we saw a lot of reactions on the app to bubble tea. And since there isn't an emoji right now for bubble tea, what we found is people would sequence together existing emoji to describe this concept. So they would use the tea emoji, usually with the milk emoji, and they call it the medium black circle emoji. But basically, it looks like a black circle.
So they were making their own bubble tea emoji because there wasn't one.
Exactly. So they were trying to communicate this concept of having bubble tea at these locations by reusing existing emoji.
And so, Melissa, I bet there are people listening who think, why is this important? Why does it matter that people have bubble tea emoji or an emoji who reflects that they can pick their skin color in an emoji? Why is this important to you?
I think for me, it's really about representation and reflection. I mean, I'm an avid social media user, and I think it's just for the same reason that movies and things like Black Panther and other elements that are taking place around the world as well are so important. It's being able to sort of to see yourself reflected in different parts of communication methods and being able to sort of floss gracefully with who you are, right? You know, I'd never use a white fist or a yellow fist to represent who I am, and I think it's so important to be able to be your true authentic self. Wherever you are and whatever form of communication.
And there's an interesting point here, I think, about tech companies' role in this, right? And Melissa, I think it's interesting that Tinder actually had a hand in getting that interracial emoji off the ground because, and Ranjith, I'd love for you to weigh in here too. I imagine that's actually a kind of an unusual stance for a tech company because oftentimes there's sort of a mindset of putting the technology out there and then the companies are pretty hands off. Melissa?
I think I welcome the approach, and I think we've seen it not just with Tinder, but most recently with Apple as well, and the accessibility emoji. So we've got like the guide dog and the hearing aid, and the man with the cane coming as well. I think there's a responsibility from the platform providers to sort of reflect the people who use their tools and their platforms as well, and not just leave that onus on the individuals to campaign and push for diversity and inclusion.
Right. And so do you think there would be a sorry emoji, Melissa, if you hadn't said, I want a sorry represented?
I think it would have come eventually. And I'm glad that I stepped in and got it done. But I think it definitely would have come. I think if you take a look at sort of the chatter and the clamor on social media for people asking for a sorry emoji, I think it definitely would have made its way, just maybe a little bit later down the road.
I can't imagine how many wedding seasons people have gone through in India without having a sorry emoji.
I know.
Yeah, I want to thank Melissa personally for that. I am Indian American, and I'm looking forward to using it.
So Ranjitha, I wonder if we could just end, I'm curious just your thoughts on that. What Melissa was saying about how she thinks it's incumbent on tech platforms to be more inclusive. I think obviously if they were, we wouldn't have groups like Emoji Nation, but I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I feel like at the end of the day, it's still, you know, the vendors who are implementing these emoji, but I mean, it's really nice to see that there are grassroots organizations like Emoji Nation who are kind of democratizing that process so that there can be a conversation between individuals and what they care about as well as with the vendors, basically. And I know that, for example, we wrote the proposal for bubble tea, apparently during the subcommittee meetings, like Facebook also supported it, and that's, you know, that helped it get passed. So it's hard to prove that an emoji will be used a lot before it even exists. So it's kind of useful to have the vendors involved in this process because they have the data around like how popular an emoji would be if it were in existence.
What emoji do you want to see next?
Oh, wow. that's a good question.
Well, you think about that, yeah. Melissa. Do you have an emoji? What's your next emoji you want out there?
Probably plantain, because I'm of West Indian heritage, so I could do with some plantains.
Yeah, everybody could do with some plantains.
I
like that.
Polar bear would be mine. Hopefully it's coming soon.
I want to thank Ranjitha Kumar for being with us, an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Illinois, and Melissa Thermidor, an emoji activist, as she's been sharing with us her work with Emoji Nation. Melissa and Ranjitha, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. Follow us on Twitter, search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All those links and every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify now, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montecelio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering come from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.